That, again, is why film is better than digital, Kevin. You'll learn someday, okay?
I don't care.
When we last left off our podcast.
That's right, Sacrilege. I am one of those people who really don't care.
Torture.
35 versus digital print. We'll get into that discussion later.
Join us on our
we're having a
splinter podcast.
We should make a list
topics.
At some point. Yeah, just hot topics.
Today on Hot
you
Takes.
You and I can discuss, you know, stuff like Serbian film.
Can we do that? Hot Takes with Kevin and Joe. It can be like a new age Siskel and Ebert, but way quicker and way more.
We'll be shirtless dynamic. The whole time.
Cool. I have been working out, you know.
I haven't.
Just for this podcast. I can tell. I see your Facebook account sometimes.
It takes a lot of work to get a body like this, let me tell you.
All right. Well, guess what? It's number 14, Marathon Chat. No song this time.
No, there's a song. There's always a song. Oh, not, you're not singing a song.
No, I'm
there's
not
always
sing
the
a
intro
song.
Music.
Yeah.
Which is from both Evil Dead and Creepshow.
I think I taught myself last time when I sang Prince. So I'm not even going to try.
You were quoted on the message
now,
board.
I was.
For Prince.
I was. And I am not confirming nor denying that I was sued by Prince right afterwards.
I don't think he knows.
My representation tells me I should probably shut up about that. So anyway.
Yeah.
Hey, we're back. So, okay. Last time we rolled right up to the end of the 1999 Nightmare at Studio 35, the final, or not the final, the first Freudian slip. First Studio 35 marathon. And
in November.
In November, yeah, the oddball November one. So, once again, if you haven't ever joined us before for this little ridiculous Quixotian quixotic venture, as I'm putting my hand over my eye again, doing the Picard face palm once again, the whole concept of this is we're doing an oral history of the history of the Columbus Marathons, primarily the lineage of the Drexel ones. And the ones that I organized as well. The ones Kevin and I have the most direct
if it's something that
experience with.
Either Joe didn't organize or I didn't attend, we're just kind of not.
Yeah. Maybe someday.
Just because we don't have a whole lot to talk
maybe
about.
Someday we'll go back to those.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch, and that's not to disparage those.
No. And it would be interesting to do like a alternate side of other events over the years. But someday. Yeah, we're too busy right now. We're too busy, like, looking at our own shoes right now. So,
okay.
So the thing is, the concept, again, is we pick X amount of time to talk about per podcast. Mm. And with minimal prep, we talk about everything associated with those marathons. Today is a very special episode of this podcast, and it's weird because the time we're going to be covering is the years 2000 and 2001, which arguably had the least amount of marathon activity of any span that we're going to discuss. However, there are some really good stories associated with this two-year span, and Kevin, because I love him so much, and he's smiling, and he's all googly-eyed, moon-eyed at me right now as I say this. Today, I'm giving him an exclusive, and that is a story that I don't think I have ever formally told on the record, especially in public or in a recorded format, about an aspect of the marathons that you may have never heard of. Ooh. I'm going to warn you when this part of the podcast comes up.
It is raw!
Because some of you might not want to hear this.
And sexy.
This might annihilate part of how some of you view the marathons. So I'll warn you.
You may be overselling this just a little bit.
Well, I know there's some sensitive souls out there. And maybe I'm thinking, if I knew this back when I was 9.
I think how I allegedly destroyed the MST premiere maybe has greater impact
Boy,
on marathon
I tell
history.
You, people come up to me in the streets and they just look at me glassy-eyed and they say, I'll never look at it the same again. It's all his fault. So I'll give a little warning here in just a short bit. So if you want to fast forward in the podcast and you want a certain aspect of marathon history to remain how most people think of it, unblemished, you can have it remain that way. Okay?
Okay.
We'll get to that, though.
Good.
So,
let's start off with the 18th annual Ohio 24 Hour Science Fiction Marathon. After the days at the Rife Center and then the Continent.
Brief stopover at the Continent.
Did they not go back to the Continent just because? What was the reason for that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we talked about this last time.
It was
I don't know.
Money? Well, we don't know?
I don't know. I
want to rent it?
Well, here's the confluence of events that happened was, I believe it was late 99, early 2000, was when the Drexel, after years of trying to open a theater downtown, they finally came into a deal with Nationwide to begin building what would be the Arena Grand.
Yeah.
And I believe around that time they knew that. And they thought, well, this will be the future home for the marathons. How about for 1 year, we take it back to one of our own theaters, do it there, and then the following year, we'll be at Arena Grand. That way, we don't have to rent the theater. We don't have to deal with a third party, blah, blah, blah. I think that's how it turned out. Because I remember going into SF18 at Grandview, spring 2000. That was the message beforehand was, the Arena Grand is on its way. Yeah. And this will be the new...
They had like a schematic or something.
Yeah, they did. You're right. This would be the shining new Valhalla for the marathons. Mm-hmm. And that was the main reason.
Okay.
As far as I can remember. So
I went to the Grand... Because the attendance was more than the Drexel would hold, right? Because the Drexel Grandview, what was the 250?
The main house in the Drexel Grandview then, and as far as I know now, is right around 300, same as the Drexel.
Oh, okay.
It was...
The main house, was there...
Oh, the house at the Grandview was and should still be today the same as the main house at the Drexel.
Okay.
Now, the Drexel might have the option if they wanted to have like a night flight or a spillover like they've tried a few times to do that, but they weren't going to shut down the whole theater and three screens to accommodate more people unless they were just bursting at the seams and Arnold Schwarzenegger was there.
Yeah.
Anything else like that.
Which he was not.
No.
So then we head back to the Grandview.
Yes, for this
back week. When it was... Run by the Drexel.
Back when it was the Drexel Grandview, yeah. This was, in fact, a year and a half after, or just over a year after I left as manager there.
Oh, okay. So, any stories on this one? You just attended this one. Did you organize it all?
Well, here's the thing. SF18 is a weird part of my life, because spring 2000, I was about to graduate from Ohio State. I was kind of wrapped up in trying to finish up my last quarter there, because this marathon happens in April. So, yeah, I basically have, like, I'm in the last 2 months of my schooling.
Yeah.
My education. I'm in the last 2 months of that. I'm also now involved enough with the marathons, because, like, the horror marathon is my thing.
Yeah.
That I kind of have, I feel more ownership over my involvement in the events.
Yeah.
And this begins a period, and some of you might wonder about this. Most of you probably won't even notice, but this begins a period where, because my involvement with planning marathons was growing larger and my knowledge of what it took to book a marathon and organize a marathon was becoming larger, I started experiencing a little more dissatisfaction with the direction of sci-fi at that point, mainly with the Drexel end of things. Part of it is, you know, I worked for the Drexel too. This is a classic thing where you know, I don't want to put this out like I had some weird feud with the Drexel at that point.
Yeah.
But to me, knowing about that stuff, knowing about, you know, learning more about the marathons, getting to know Bruce more at that point, because he and I were really starting to become friends. And I learned just about everything I ever learned about the marathons from him. Mm-hmm. At that point, I start getting a little frustrated with some of where the Drexel is going with the direction of the event, the booking of the event, some of the timing of the promotions, how, you know, I was feeling very much at the time like sci-fi was starting to struggle because of factors that could be controlled.
Yeah.
And so some
theater location, dates,
all those things. And it just, some of my opinions about this might be a little colored because of that. Mm-hmm. We're entering a weird period where I still enjoyed going to sci-fi. But there was more frustration hanging over my head than there had been before, even a year or two before.
Yeah.
And the confluence of those events for SF18 mean that I have far less great memories of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it's the lineup. I think there's some strong films. But
I like the lineup. You know what's interesting with the lineup? And this is going to happen several times. I have conflicting memories at this time, because at this time,
you know why? Because you're old.
Well,
because
it's all the drugs I took. No, it's
wait, I took those drugs with you. Didn't
oh, I don't know. I don't remember.
Whoa, man.
No, but
hello.
there was this weird switchover from when I was in high school and college, and I had a group of friends that would go with me, and then now I take my kids. But there is this netherworld of about 10 years where I was always just trying to find somebody to go with.
Yeah.
And by the time I got married, my wife was like, I'm not going to these. I started doing filmmaking in the early 2000s, and not at this point yet, but that comes into play. I just started dragging my friends who were working in film with me
yeah.
to them. Now there's a story that dovetails into that. But like for example, Frequency. There was sneak preview of Frequency this year. That was not the first time they showed it. That it was shown in town, correct? Wasn't there like a sneak preview somewhere else?
I have no idea.
The reason I ask is because I went with my wife to see, and we ended up seeing Frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might have been actually at Studio 35 where we saw it.
It was not because I was working at Studio at that point.
Well, whatever it was, we saw it somewhere, but unless you saw it at this marathon, but I don't recall her being at this marathon when they showed Tron and the Iron Giant, because I believe I went, I hung out with Joe Caroni at the time.
Yeah.
He was in Columbus. And Joe and I went to, because I remember sitting with him during Iron Giant. I'm like, I don't think my wife would have been with us. So I'm getting these conflicts. So I think actually Frequency may have been a premiere. It was a sneak preview, but I think that they were doing early sneaks elsewhere in other venues.
They might have been, yeah. Well, the thing I remember about Frequency is I didn't think they would get it because it seemed too big.
Yeah.
So when they did, I do remember there was a notable excitement in a lot of the crowd that, oh, wow, we're getting this big film.
Yeah.
Now, whether they had done some small sneak previews before then, I don't know. But I don't remember there being any kind of a swell amongst the crowd of people saying, oh, they already did a sneak like a week ago, or they did that.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know.
I think this was... I can't remember when we...
Because I remember, like I said, I remember seeing it in a theater like the Grandview or the Studio or someplace like that with my wife.
Well, and in the program, it's listed as a special premiere, but it doesn't say what...
It's not like an Ohio Columbus
premiere. Now, that might have just been something where the studio, because that was New Line, where they wanted to let them screen it for some reason, but they didn't want it to be noted as like the first Columbus screening.
Because they've done
For technical reasons, maybe.
Well, they've
know.
Done that like when they did, then they showed, this is jumping ahead a little bit outside of this frame, but when they showed Saw was actually not screened in Columbus for press, but I remember I saw it at the marathon.
Yeah, we had the legit, at least Columbus premiere of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. It's weird for Frequency with me because I was not excited to see that film. Because to me, and this is looking back at me at 23, I thought, oh, that's a sellout.
You're such a dick.
I don't, I was in a really weird place mentally with this marathon because to me, part of it too is to me, this is my second year attending the Boston Sci-Fi.
Yeah.
And at the Boston Sci-Fi, they showed The Iron Giant, Top of the Food Chain, Tron, and Death Race 2000, and I had just seen those recently. And to me, this is something where I've always had a hard time, lesser lately, but I've always had a hard time separating the fact that like, oh, hey, guess what, Joe? You and like three other people went to Boston. No one else in the crowd did. That's your own fault for going up there. But for me, my personal interest in the lineup waned a bit because to me, all I was thinking was, oh, wait, Columbus should be able to differentiate themselves from Boston and not book like four or five of the titles Boston already showed this year 2 months beforehand.
Yeah.
There's probably some legitimacy in that retroactively, but also that was totally on me. So some of the titles I was less excited to see. So when Frequency came up, I'm 23 and I'm still thinking, oh, it's a big mainstream schmaltzy sci-fi film. Who wants to see that? Today, if we got the opportunity to show that, yeah, absolutely. I'd say let's jump at it because that's good for the event. When we did some publicity for the Divergent sequel.
Yeah.
At the horror marathon, Insurgent. For a minute, the way they phrased it, I almost thought, oh, wait, do they want us to it's sci-fi.
Yeah.
I said, for a minute, I thought, wait, do they want us to premiere this? And even though I have no interest in those films, if they had come to us with Insurgent and said, hey, do you want to have like one of the first sneak previews in town of this film?
Mm-hmm.
I said, sure, yeah, because that would draw people in. That would create some kind of buzz to get people in. And I don't think it would have ruined the marathon to show Insurgent as a premiere, as a special thing.
No, I mean, it's a legitimate sci-fi movie. Yeah. Although, what would be interesting about something like that, which is less of an issue with Frequency, because Frequency is a little more, even though it's a little more arguably time travel romance-y kind of thing, Insurgent's very much the fangirl thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The modern Twilight, Hunger Games fan
group. Which at sci-fi this year would have made perfect sense because we had the big women in sci-fi theme.
Well, it goes well with the theme, but the core marathon audience is not that. It's sort of like when I went to Comic-Con in 2008 and they had the Twilight panel and it pissed off all the fanboys because you just was just filled with teenage girls.
Yeah. You could potentially, I love how I suddenly got this off on talking about a hypothetical screening that never actually was going to happen anyway. You could potentially, if we had done that, you could have had maybe some new blood come in that would have at least given the event even more of like a sense of excitement. And I don't think you would have just gotten a crowd of teenage girls coming in and ruining the event.
Probably not for Insurgent. No. But yeah, it definitely if it was like a Twilight movie. Although I still am a proponent of
I know, we've had that debate many times.
All right, are there any stories you have from here? I remember seeing Tron on the big screen and it being cool.
It's a weird marathon because of the reasons I listed for me. My big thing that year was I bought a military outfit, a full set of fatigues and a hat, and I came and entered the costume contest. I had a gas mask on.
Oh.
And I think I was trying to portray myself as like...
You could have just put a beret on.
I know. I think I was trying to portray myself as like the rebel or the heretic.
Yeah.
Because now I ran the horror marathon and it was at another theater and I was like the invader. I don't know what I was thinking.
Wow, that is high concept.
I was so stupid. Well, the weird thing was...
That was no bagpiping gorilla, let me
tell
you.
No. I tried to cut a promo on the crowd during the costume contest about, you know, that I'm the enemy. I don't know what I was thinking back then. If there's a video of it, it looks ridiculous. So...
Find that video.
Yeah,
is what we're
please.
Saying.
I think someone videotaped it. Well, it's weird for me because I remember watching the first couple films, but then like Planet of the Apes, the print wasn't that great. I think I went out and talked to some of my friends in the lobby. Top of the Food Chain I had just seen in Boston a month before.
I don't remember that one.
That was the. It's actually a really good parody of 50 sci-fi films. It's like what Larry Blamire tries to do, and I think. Fails to do.
Yeah, this is what, like, I love Incredible Shrinking Man. I don't recall seeing that.
Yeah.
I don't recall seeing it at the marathon. No. I don't know what it was about this marathon that some I saw and some I didn't.
Too much drugs, kid.
Yeah.
Too much
I remember seeing
drugs.
Death Race 2. I mean, Men in Black was at 4 a.m. I probably slept through that.
Yeah. Well, Top of the Food Chain, I had just seen, and I like it a lot, but I literally just seen it 2 months before. Then Frequency, I thought it was a sellout, blah, blah, blah. Tron, I had just seen in Boston, and the print they had at Grandview was decidedly inferior to the one in Boston.
Yeah.
The original Midwest premiere was supposed to be Brian Usna's produced Progeny, but that fell through, so they had X, the anime film. I think I slept through that. And then I didn't want to see Men in Black again. I was like 3 years old. I didn't care.
Yeah.
Death Race 2000, I had just seen in Boston. Fifth Element, I didn't want to see it again at that point. That was only a couple years old, so I fell asleep for that.
Yeah.
And around this time, too, one of my good friends was... flying into the marathon that day, and he was late. He got stuck in Texas. In fact, at one point, we did... one of my other friends had a cell phone. A cell phone? Whoa!
Back in the tooth.
He had Scott, my friend, call in from Texas from the airport, and they brought him up to the microphone. Said, hey, everybody, tell my friend Scott that... hi, he's trying to get here before the end of the marathon. So Scott showed up late, and because there were enough people, I had to vacate my seat so he could sit down. I think it was one of those where, like, I volunteered. I said, look, let Scott sit down. I'll stand up. But I ended up not having anywhere to sit for, like, 4 or 5 movies. And I think that also increased my sense of, like, well, this isn't fun.
Yeah.
And I think this was one of the first marathons where I sat with what became my huge group of friends from the Dayton area.
Yeah.
But it was still new enough that like I only really knew a couple of them.
Yeah.
So I just have all sorts of weird feelings about this event and the fact that it went from Continent to Grandview. And I thought, I don't know about that. Maybe that's too small and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think it's okay looking back on it now. I think that there are a couple weak spots in the lineup. Like, I still don't think Men in Black and The Fifth Element at that time were the films to show.
It's always a danger to show something that is that recent. Always is.
Yeah. But then again, I know people.
Because stuff like The Iron Giant went over like gangbusters.
Oh, yeah.
But Men in Black was, I think. Part of it is because Iron Giant was underseen.
Yes. Yeah.
Men in Black certainly was not.
I think maybe that's part of it where you get Fifth Element, Men in Black, Frequency, Top of the Food Chain, Iron Giant, another premiere. There's so much new stuff at that point, or relatively new stuff. And you have to remember, too, at that time, the marathon had still made its bones on premieres and classic stuff.
Yeah.
So that just seemed like an odd way to go at that point. But anyway, it's a weird event. I told you, like, I pulled this program and flyer out last night for the first time in ages. And there are some definite high points to it. It just, Yeah, a lot of like anything in life, maybe there are so many factors that go into your perception of what something was. It seemed to be an event that went over fairly well. Yeah. That's about all I know. And there was that excitement about the Arena Grand that was building.
Yeah. Well, let's move on then to the first annual Psychorama Film Festival.
Oh boy, and here we go. Here is where this epic story, this epic untold story begins. Now, at this point, I can tell this part of the story, and you can listen to this. So don't fast forward just yet. Here was my situation at Studio 35 at that time. Way back in the day, you'll recall the end of the 1999 Nightmare at Studio 35, which I thought was turning into a disaster. John Conti, my boss at Studio 35, said, look, we lost about $500 on this, but you know what? It was good for the theater. Let's do it again next year. Mm. And I'm chomping at the bit because I realize now I get to continue doing this thing I love and this thing I wanted to resurrect. So I'm like planning early in the spring for what the horror marathon will be. And I'm throwing together a bunch of ideas and I'm really excited. And at that point, I happen upon this side idea. And my side idea was, hey, we should really turn Studio into the home of the marathons.
Yeah.
Because my grand idea was that eventually I would convince Bruce to bring the Sci-Fi Marathon to Studio 35. That it would be such a bastion for marathons and be such a great place to do them that I would convince him we should have them all under one roof.
And you had a window of 6 months to do this in?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let's say
just
that.
Just poking
yeah.
holes in your story of a 23-year-old idiot.
No, but that was my theory though, because I thought I love these things and I would love for him to come to Studio and basically do the event exactly the way he wants to. Because that was my deal with Studio throughout the entire run, was I basically got to do the marathon the way I wanted to. And that was complete creative control. That was amazing. Yeah. So as part of that, I thought, you know what we should do? We should resurrect one of the all-night marathons. And I look specifically at Schlock Around the Clock, I should say.
Yeah.
The much beloved, I guess much beloved, mildly beloved, all-night
B-movie. No Pretty Peaches videos on this one.
So I got this idea. I said, you know what would be cool? If we did an all-nighter that was kind of like that, and we did it in the summer, and we had that marathon be the kickoff event for the horror marathon. Mm. So I thought to myself, hey, 23-year-old genius, Schlock Around the Clock didn't do too well its second time around. What if you hedge your bets and you do an all-night marathon that is B-movies but also has some legit good movies, and you kind of expand it past just B-movies into rock and roll films, into exploitation films, into cult movies.
Yeah.
Thus was born the first annual Psychorama Film Festival, as I called it. And it was an all-nighter, and it was supposed to encompass cult movies, rock and roll movies, B-movies, exploitation, bad stuff, all sorts of things. Mm. You know, and there's a certain logic to that, right?
Yeah.
That if some people will come see just B-movies, and Schlock Around the Clock was never just bad movies. I mean, there was actually some decent, you know, B-type movies in there. But if people will come to see that, hey, people will probably come to see an expanded menu that has actual good cult movies in it, too.
Yeah.
So I convinced John to let me do this in August, and it was, in fact, the last weekend of August, and that would serve as the kickoff for the second annual Nightmare at Studio 35. Yeah. So behind the scenes, I'm working on the Studio 35 marathon and getting almost all the titles booked so we can announce them at Psychorama. So Psychorama, if you look at the lineup, and I have in front of me the original flyer, and you've got the lineup on
it's the same one. There were no replacements, right?
There was one replacement. And that was Eraserhead.
Oh, okay.
The original advertised lineup was Reefer Madness, a perennial, at least at that time. Russ Meyer's Beyond the Valley of the Dolls always plays well. David Lynch's Eraserhead, which ended up getting replaced by Blue Velvet because we couldn't get Eraserhead.
Yeah.
Psych Out with Jack Nicholson and Bruce Dern and Dean Stockwell, Susan Strasberg, classic psych paranoia movie. Pam Grier and Foxy Brown. Sid and Nancy, and I believe it was the Ohio premiere of the new trauma film, Terror Firmer.
Yes.
Which I still think, in terms of just a lineup to sit down to watch, this is a pretty solid lineup. There's not really any true stinkers in there, depending on your love of Terror Firmer. I only saw part of it through that.
Is that the one with the naked guy running
it's
around?
It's a trauma film. They all have naked
guys. Well, he had a mask on and his phalange was flapping around.
I forget. I really do.
I can't remember that. Was that or Tromeo? Do you ever show Tromeo and Juliet?
No, but I did see Tromeo and Juliet. Well, my copy for the flyer says, studio founder Lloyd Kaufman spins the twisted tale of a low-budget film crew terrorized by a maniacal killer with plenty of the gore, nudity, and tastelessness that we all have come to expect from our old friends at Troma.
Aww.
I don't know what that means. Anyway, so we have this lineup,
yeah,
and we get the word on at it about a month in advance. And there are a couple slip-ups with this event, and a few of them I'll admit to. First of all, doing this event at the end of August. I don't think this was like quite the slip-up that I thought it might be. Today it would work out somewhat better because Ohio State would be back by that point in August.
Oh,
back then, Ohio State wasn't back, and most of the universities weren't back until
middle
September.
Of September, yeah.
So I think we kind of cut ourselves off a bit there. We were also a theater that was still in a very nascent stage of promoting events like this. I was someone who was in a very nascent stage of promoting events like this. So, and maybe I misjudged the crowd. Maybe yeah. I misjudged the price. Although advance was $15, that wasn't anything that was too cheap.
Yeah.
But I think a combination of things led to that. And so one other thing that I think hurt us a bit is, I went on vacation at the end of July, and literally the night before I went on vacation, I finished the flyer and the ticket for the event and turned them into the theater so they could take them to the printer. The original time for the event was supposed to be 10 p.m. Saturday night until noon Sunday, because pretty much every all-nighter that had ever happened in Columbus was either 10 p.m. to noon or midnight to noon. And I thought, well, people are used to that. They're used to, you know, a late night event.
Yeah.
I got back from being on vacation, and unbeknownst to me, and in fact, no one told me literally until someone had to point it out on the flyer to me. Unbeknownst to me, while I was gone, John changed the starting time for the event. He changed it to 8 p.m. instead of 10 p.m.
Okay.
8 p.m. to 10 a.m. was when it actually ran.
Was that in order to get the movies showing on Sunday?
No. His theory was, we make most of our money selling beer. True. And I want more time to sell beer. It pissed me off at that time because
the flyer there says 10 p.m.
Yeah, this is the original. Oh, this is the rare original version.
That was your mock-up, right?
This was like something I printed off in limited numbers beforehand.
Oh, okay.
It pissed me off because we had agreed on that time, and I had told him why that time should be that way.
Yeah.
And he just kind of changed it without even calling me, you know.
But you were on holiday.
Yes, I was on holiday. And it felt to me like it was last minute stuff and that it was going to hurt the event. I don't know how I feel about that today. I still contend we might have had slightly better success if we had started at 10 instead of 8 p.m. Because 8 p.m. Saturday night seems kind of oddball to me, especially for a theater that had never promoted something like that before. I don't think it killed it. I don't think that was the reason why there were some struggles.
Maybe
for
lost
that.
Five tickets.
But it kind of soured me just a little bit. Now, I'll say this now. I've said this before, and I'll say it again before this is done. John was the best boss I ever had at a job. And by boss, I mean the guy running the show. I've had direct supervisors who might have been a little better, but they also didn't have to run the whole show.
Yeah.
John being that guy, John is still one of the most honest, fair, cool people I have ever worked for. Mm-hmm. Probably the most honest, fair, cool person I've ever worked for. And I've told him this several times. We had disagreements over the years, you know, like anyone does. And I don't think that's speaking out of turn. Me saying this stuff is not to say, like, he didn't know what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of context for what had happened and what was about to happen.
Yeah.
So we get to the event that night, and the crowd's pretty good. And we had, I think, 102, 105.
That's not bad.
No, not bad at all. And the crowd actually really enjoyed the event.
Yeah.
And the whole plan for the event was the following. We would bring people to the event, and in the weeks before, we would say, hey, guess what? At the Horror Marathon, or at Psychorama, we're going to tell you what almost all the Horror Marathon films are.
Oh, okay.
And we are actually...
Because it's August. I mean, you should be able to.
And we're not only we're going to do that, but for one night only, we're going to sell special discount advance tickets. I think the original price of the Horror Marathon was going to be like 22 in advance. We're going to sell them to you for $18 this night only. And we have special tickets. I have a copy right here, and we sold like between 15 and 20 that night alone.
Oh, wow.
And for me, that was really exciting because all of a sudden, there's momentum. From that event the year before, now people know we're doing it at Studio 35. Mm-hmm. And there's real momentum and there's some excitement. So we got there, we showed, what was it, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls showed first, followed by Blue Velvet. Wow. And I believe it was either right before Blue Velvet or right after Blue Velvet. I got up in front of the audience and said, hey, here is a trailer reel. I think almost all that we borrowed from Bruce. Here's a trailer reel of what is going to show at the Horror Marathon in a month and a half. Hope you get excited for it.
Yeah.
And if you want to buy tickets for it, tonight you can buy these special advance. After that, they go to 22 in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Memorably, when we showed Beyond the Valley of the Dolls right afterwards, we had a Beyond the Valley of the Dolls imitation contest.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who I believe won it, or at least placed in the money, did a ace imitation of Ronnie Z-Man Barzell. You've seen Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, right?
Unfortunately, a couple times,
Yeah.
The one with... Spoiler alert.
The Z-Man, the one who becomes Superwoman.
Yes.
Yes, the black sperm of my vengeance.
Yes, him.
This guy did a really ace impersonation
of
him.
Did he rip his shirt off in the process?
No, he didn't. He was just really good. And that guy turned out to be Mike Olenek. The director of Red Luck. That was the first time I ever met Mike, was when he was still in art school in Cincinnati, and he came up for this event.
Uh-huh.
And little did I know that 14 years later, Mike would be showing like this avant-garde horror short film at one of our marathons. And that Mike and I would be good friends too. So from the oddest, strangest beginnings.
Wow.
Come interesting bits of marathon lore. So anyway, we showed those trailers.
Yeah.
And I'm holding right in front of me.
Believe you me.
The long lost advanced teaser flyer for the second annual Nightmare at Studio 35, which I put out right after we showed the trailers and people could pick it up. The lineup we promoted that night, we didn't have trailers for all of these, but we had for most, was Bloodsucking Freaks, Troma subclassic, the Roger Corman AIP version of The Raven, Don't Look Now, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the film.
Don't.
The Ohio premiere of Rock and Roll Frankenstein. Oh, God, I've still only seen parts of this. This was going to be our first big premiere. A modern-day Frankenstein is trying to assemble a Frankenstein's monster out of the dead body parts of famous rock stars. What could possibly go wrong? Well, he goes to get Jim Morrison's penis, and it breaks, or it, you know, whatever happens. So instead, he gets...
It's been a while.
Liberace's penis. Hello. So hilarity ensues, I guess. This had one of the greatest...
I'm sure that there was plenty of other rock penises lying around.
Yeah, I guess.
A lot of dead rock stars and a lot of dead rock penises.
This had one of the great tasteless promo items I've ever seen for a film. They sent us a whole bunch of stuff. No, it was a condom with a rat inside of it.
Like a real rat?
No, like a rubber rat.
Like a real rat.
Yeah.
Do not open it.
Yeah. It was beautiful.
Rotting.
And then from there we had John Carpenter's remake of The Thing, The Omen... The Hunger, yes. First attempt. Well, second attempt at showing that, actually.
You always show that movie.
Yeah.
It's your favorite movie ever.
George Romero's Night of the Living Dead and Tom Savini's remake of Night of the Living Dead, because we were trying to get Romero to come in for the marathon that year. And that would have necessitated a little bit of change, but we were going to bookend those two. And then the original Nosferatu with live music by the Weird Lovemakers, which would have been really cool. I had seen them perform a score for that in the back of Monkey's Retreat. Like 2 years before, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
So, we had that whole thing. Now, Psychorama itself, fun. Yes, you were at it. Oh, yeah, of course, because
you
want
to tell this story, or?
This is where the strings come in the background, and things get really romantic and misty, because Psychorama is really the event that marked the beginning of this beautiful friendship that Kevin and I have had. Tell the story, Kevin. Tell it in full.
I was, at the time, dabbling in filmmaking, and one of the things I was doing is I was shooting a mockumentary, and it was called Going Corporate.
That's the love story theme.
Yeah. And then I got cancer and I died looking beautiful like Alan McGraw.
I said love means never having to say Kevin is dead.
No. So I was shooting this mockumentary, and I just quit my job, And I was shooting it. I didn't quit my job because of that. I was doing freelance at the same time. But it was basic. It was like The Office. It actually predated The Office.
Yes.
It was a mockumentary that took place in an office. And I was, had a group of guys in the IT department that I wanted. They were just slobs and would, they're ne'er-do-wells. They just sat around playing solitaire all day. There's one guy who in every scene in the movie, his computer was off and his back was to the computer. Even when his manager comes in. So I said, oh, wouldn't it be neat to just kind of get, cause you want to, when you shoot a movie like that, you want to get out of the office. You want to change up the location a little bit. So I said, well, why don't I have us do some interviews with these guys and show them going to this all night movie marathon? Cause I love these things. And so I can't remember. Did I get in touch with you via email first? Did you have your Marathoid email all set up at that time?
I was on Hotmail at that time.
I can't remember whether.
I think I might have had a Studio 35 email too.
Well, because I know
for a brief time
I had corresponded with Bruce before because we had at the last. Oh no, we hadn't shown this yet. So this
Ghost,
was the first
Ghost Reader is another.
That's a
two
later,
years
yeah,
away.
A
yeah.
But anyway, so I somehow I got in touch with you and I was like, hey. I told you what I wanted to do. I say, I go to these things, but I can't go this year. But can we come and shoot there? And you were really cool about it. You're like, yeah, as long as you're not disrupting the event. I said, yeah, we just walked out. We might be, we'll do it during the trailer. We won't interrupt the movie.
Because then you came in, you came in like the week before the event. And that's when I really first met you officially.
Yeah.
And we talked for a while. And I thought, this guy's crazy.
Insane.
I love him.
Leave him alone. Yeah. Call the police immediately.
Yeah.
Well,
that's when I met Joe Caroni too, was around that same time.
Was around that time. Okay. Yeah. Cause, and so you're really cool. So I came and I brought these guys over and I forget how we timed it. Cause I remember sitting in the lobby watching part of Terra Firma.
Yeah.
Because this was at the studio cause you could see through the studio. You couldn't see through at the Grandview, could you?
At that time you could see through the bar at studio.
Yeah, I remember seeing it through the bar. But so I brought these guys down and we waited till you did the trailers. And I remember it was during the trailer for Blood Feast or Blood Sucking Freaks or whatever. It was pretty crazy. And we just showed them go in and buy popcorn and go down, sit in the front. I just took, I don't know, it was like a minute of footage.
Yeah, yeah.
Followed them down with the camera, walked back up. I never actually used that footage, but I used some of the interviews that we shot outside the theater, and it looked really good because it was not an office. It was something different. It was at night, and, you know, so that's how we did it. And I mean, I since I was working there, I couldn't stick around for the marathon, and I had other things to do because we were shooting that over. We shot the film over Labor Day weekend.
Okay.
So I think we must have shot this first because that was a week before Labor
Yes.
Day weekend.
Yeah.
So I was still in mad prep for the shoot
Okay.
that was going to be going on, but we did that and that was really fun. So I was, you know, and like I said, I only walked through the movie house in the trailers
mm-hmm.
with the camera. And then we got out of everybody's hair. But I remember we had him sit in the front row. Nobody was in the front row.
And I remember what was weird was that somehow I knew Joe better than you at that point. Joe, I think
I worked with Joe.
Yeah. And
I knew him well enough because I knew him as a colleague.
Joe came into the theater, maybe for regular shows, and that's how I met him.
Yeah.
And you kind of, then I met you through him, because I remember for that year thinking, oh, you're the guy who hangs out with Joe. My, yeah. How things have changed.
I know.
Now you are the guy who hangs out
with
Joe.
I hang out with a different Joe.
God, it all just works out.
Joe's got a legitimate job drawing Star Wars and shit. No, but it was so funny because... yeah, you're right. It was probably the first time that we ever interacted.
Yeah.
Aside from me just saying that crazy man
for those of you
homemade shirt.
Those of you who hate these podcasts, stop listening to them, first of all.
That,
no
yeah.
one's forcing you
Why?
To. But you can blame the Psychorama in some ways for the beginning of this weird little riff-tacular existence that we have now.
Well, and it's funny because I was never a big fan of the schlock around the clock, partly because of the lineup. I probably would have preferred this one. This is a much better lineup, I thought. It's because it's more solid movies. Girl Can't Help It's not on this list and stuff like that.
Yeah. So this was good. And even though I had my qualms about some of the changes to the event, we came out of it on a real high note. And me being the 23-year-old mad genius wannabe dictator of all things that I was trying to build my little marathon empire at this point, I'm really excited. And we're essentially, I think at that point, we were going to start putting tickets on sale for the horror marathon a week and a half later, maybe 2 weeks later, beginning of September. Maybe the Friday after Labor Day weekend was the official on sale date. We had to get real flyers out, other things like that. Okay. So the ad event ends, walk out of there on Saturday. This is your fright break, to borrow a term from William Castle, your fright break warning. I'm about to tell an exclusive story I've never told before on the record, in public, recorded form like this, about that fall. If you don't want part of marathon history ruined for you, fast forward by maybe 15 minutes.
Also known by as when the shit went down.
Yeah. Okay, you've received ample warning. Here for the first time, the exclusive story of what happened with the 2000 Nightmare at Studio 35.
So those of you still sitting around with $18 tickets.
No, they were all refunded.
Oh, okay.
I refunded almost all of them, trust me. Here's how it went. Psychorama ends Sunday morning. I come in the following Friday. I'm not sure if I worked the shift that week until then. I came in on the following Friday night, maybe Saturday night.
It was like Labor Day weekend then.
Yeah. And I came in at night to work my shift, and I looked over at the cork board, the film notes board at Studio 35, and I noticed that there was a printout there, and the printout said, if you subscribe to the Studio 35 email newsletter, you would have received this email this week. And I'm thinking, well, we used to do this, like, hey, you should subscribe to the email newsletter. This was big. This is pre-social media, pre any of that stuff. So the email newsletter was kind of the main artery for promotions. And I thought, well, he's done this before, just to show people the cool stuff they could get. Well, I start reading this. And the content of the email that he had sent out that week, this is John, unbeknownst to me, because I wasn't on the email mailing list, the content of the email was basically saying, Studio 35 is in trouble. Financially, we are not doing well, which was true. And you have to understand, at this point in Studio's history, there was like a little midpoint where a year later, things really picked back up again. And a year or two before, things had been good. But in 2000, for various reasons, not really all under Studio's control, the market for what they were showing started waning a bit. And the theater was struggling a little bit financially at that point. So Studio's struggling. The shows that we're trying to run are not as successful as we want them to be. And then it said, the Psychorama Film Festival event that we just ran lost nearly $1,000. And if business doesn't pick up soon, we might have to start shutting down during the week and only being open on weekends. Mm. This was all a blind side to me. And this is, you have to note, after what happened with the unknown switch of the time of the event, when I was gone, after we agreed on everything, this is a real blind side to me. And I'm just thinking, wait a minute, you just, to your entire email list, slammed this event, and the event is me.
Yeah.
You basically just slammed your own employee to your entire email list.
Yeah.
And again, I will say this afterwards, I'll say it again. I have no ill will towards John about this today, or even months after that. But this is the context for what happened. So, I remember I went into the office to John, I said, what the hell's this all about?
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, we're really struggling. I said, you do realize that I'm the face behind these marathons and these events, right? And that you kind of just slammed me to your entire email list. Like, I would never do that to you. Or how, like, why would you bring me up as part of the reason that your theater is struggling right now? And John would get into this sometimes. He would get into a mindset like where his default mode would be, I have to send an email out pushing the woe is me line to people to scare them into coming to the theater. Yeah. Maybe scare them is not the right term. But it always seemed like this was a last resort deal. And a lot of times it would work because people would say, I got to come back to studio. Oh, they're struggling. Let's go.
Yeah.
And I said, I just want you to know this really pisses me off that you would do this. And I said, is the theater going to be open for the horror marathon? And at the time, all he could offer me was saying, well, if we do well between now and then, it'll be open. And if we don't, it won't be. I was apoplectic at this point.
Yeah.
I said,
you had a lot more energy in you. I imagine you bouncing around
the office.
It's not a big office.
Yeah. I said, no, it wasn't. I said, I'm not going to promote an event and sell tickets to an event, especially to a lot of people who are my friends, only to the week before tell them, guess what? It's canceled.
And the theater's going bankrupt, so you can't get your money back.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I felt like how did we walk into this if I knew this was going to be this way? Because I had no real indications that it was that bad. I knew we were...
I'm just being plain devil's advocate. Yeah. Was it partly because you were so young and eager for the event that there were warning signs that you would have seen had you been doing it now? Or,
well, yeah, I mean, part of it was...
Do you think it would really just kind of came out of nowhere?
Part of it, I was 23.
Okay.
At 38, I know more about these things now, so I might be able to identify these. Mm-hmm. There didn't seem to be a real obvious sign at that point that we were in really bad financial shape. And the definition of really bad, I'm not sure how really bad that got.
Yeah.
But we were... I had worked there for a year and a half at that point, and it wasn't like all of a sudden we were significantly just like fell off the cliff business-wise from what I could see. So that's why it came as a shock. Were there times leading up to that in spring, summer 2000 when business was down? Yeah, sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it just seemed kind of out of the blue that he went to this extent. And at the time, I thought, oh, John's hitting the panic button.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no need to hit the panic button.
Yeah.
But again, I didn't know. We never had a big formal conversation. But that night, I was apoplectic. And I said, I am not going to promote...
For the record, you and John, this is all long history. You guys are friends still and everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. John's a great guy. I said that like 2 minutes ago,
I just want to reiterate that.
Yes.
I just want to make sure that...
No.
This is not some grand schism.
No, this is the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
So I just got really pissed off. And I remember I walked out of the office, and there were a stack of flyers for the Horror Marathon, of the preview flyers.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple hanging up on the film notes board. Oh, by the way, the email, the printout of the email about the theater's financial struggles and the one slamming the marathon, it was posted right underneath the Nightmare at Studio 35 teaser flyer, which pissed me off even more. That's because crazy. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Some of you in the audience at this point will say, boy, Joe, we're noticing a very common thread in a lot of these marathons, which is Joe fights against authority figures. Maybe he has a little bit oppositional defiant thing going on. Maybe I do. I don't know. You have to realize at this point, too, at this point, at 23, the marathon concept to me was like sacred.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was the keeper of a flame that... or part of a flame that had been given to me, or pick your metaphor, whatever you will, and I didn't want to screw it up.
You're running the torch.
Yeah, I'm running. It's raining. I just took a and I'm trying
and
to keep the torch
going.
Ground
is slippery, and
Bruce is back at the house with his torch, laughing at me, going, "Dumbass." So anyway, I remember walking out of the office that night, and I took the flyers off the concession stand, and I went and unpinned the flyers, took them down off the corkboard.
I have this image of you like the movie Election.
Oh God, yeah. It's one of my best,
you're like Reese Witherspoon.
Oh God,
one of my great friends,
Todd May, who I worked with there. Todd, still to this day, if you asked him about this, would probably tell the same story, and he would always say, "Oh Joe, I just remember seeing you like take that stuff down that night." I'm like, "No, Joe, don't do this. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know like this is this
he knows is, not what he does.
This is like a bad step." I just took that stuff down and I left it at that. And it was basically me saying, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to put work into this. A, if you can't guarantee me we'll even be here. And B, if you're going to slam me via email.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk for a good week or two after that about this.
Mm.
But I stopped working on that marathon completely at that point. And finally, John brought me into his office one day and said, look, I've thought about this, and it's my money, and I think it's too much of a risk to put on a 24-hour. I might do something like an all-nighter, or like three or four films one night and three or four films the next night, but I really don't want to do this. And at that point, I was in total, pardon my French, I was in total fuck you mode. Mm-hmm. I was like, look, like there's a conversation, I pulled out anyway. So I have no investment in this anymore. Now, here's what's interesting. Around this time, my buddy Tim Martin, who some of you might know from us calling him Fredo in the last podcast, which he let me know about, trust me. Sorry, Tim. Tim is much more sunny than Fredo, so he told me that too.
That's what he claims.
Yeah. Tim was planning a marathon.
Tim, meet me at the toll bridge, please. Yeah.
Tim was planning a marathon with the Drexel at that point, an all-nighter.
Mm-hmm.
And we had already arranged that we would do these on separate weekends. And the whole point was, we will not be competing.
Mm-hmm.
What's good for the goose, good for the gander. We do ours, our 24-hour one weekend, and then Drexel does their all-nighter the next weekend. Everybody's happy. And so Tim knew about this. The theater knew about this. John knew about this.
Mm-hmm.
About a week after John told me, look, I'm not going to do it no matter what, even though for me, my view was like, well, I already quit doing this anyway, so why are you telling me this? An article in the other paper comes out. And again, I didn't know about this until it actually came out. And the line was something like, Horrors, Studio 35 cancels Horror Marathon. And back in the day, the other paper, at this point, it was pretty major coverage.
That was right direct to your market.
Yeah, yeah. And it basically said, Studio 35 has canceled the Horror Marathon. And John gave a quote to John Roosh, who was writing at the other paper at that point. He gave him a quote saying, well, we saw that the Drexel was doing a horror marathon, so we decided not to do ours. And I just thought, what are you doing? You're shooting yourself in the foot. There's a lot of baggage that goes along with the Drexel studio relationship at that point.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, I think, antagonism from the Drexel towards studio, because I think they viewed them as competition, even though studio was doing a completely different ballgame. And to me, I do know for a fact that there was some
bad blood.
Yeah.
Between...
In part due to an other paper article from earlier that summer that was supposed to be about the last two independent theaters in town, but kind of painted the Drexel as being this amazing success, and studio is like this ragtag group of morons, essentially.
Yeah.
Which led to me stepping out in public for the first time, and I wrote an epic letter to the other paper saying, this is bullshit. Which also, that was what kind of struck me as being odd about the whole debacle surrounding Psychorama and the Horror Marathon was I put my neck on the line, I thought, for the theater.
Yeah.
And I made a public letter in which I slammed the Drexel. And it felt kind of like, wait a minute, I just went out and got myself shot for you. Help me out now.
Well, what I was saying is that there's a lot of it. I won't go into it, but there's a lot of inside baseball between
very much so.
Bookings and exclusive events between Drexel and studio that had been going on for years.
Yeah. And there was
antagonism, not just because from a public view, but there's a lot of behind the scenes.
Very much so.
That would be boring to people.
It would be outside of them. Needless to say, the Drexel's main product at that time was art films.
Mm-hmm.
Studio's main product at that time was more mainstream fare.
Well, but also...
Main product.
The other thing was the Drexel at the time had the Drexel Bexley. Mm-hmm.
And the Grandview.
They had the Grandview, and they were launching the Arena Grand that they were managing.
Mm-hmm.
So the Drexel was on its way up, and eventually... took over the Gateway too, and there was this. It was in this rise, the sudden resurgence of power in the theater community, in the movie theater community.
In some ways,
And studio just was studio, and you know, John running the theater. There's only so much you could do with one theater.
Yes.
So I think there was some of that where you were a little bit of a David and Goliath going on.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, and naturally there was that aspect of it, just because the Drexel had more screens and had more history with, and had more
theaters.
Prestige.
Well, and then they could say, well, we're going to show all the art house stuff in Bexley. We're going to show the more niche stuff in Grandview, and we're going to do all the mainstream stuff.
I can tell you for a fact, though, at that time, any kind of bad blood was not based around the mainstream stuff.
No.
And without getting into it anymore, it wasn't there. I don't want to get into too much of this because there's a lot of insider baseball.
I know a lot of stuff behind the scenes.
It was dumb in some ways, and it wasn't necessary.
It was petty.
Yeah. But there was
small business relationships. That's
Yeah. Getting back to the main story. So this article is published in the other paper, and I'm just saying, John, you're shooting yourself in the foot because you're making yourself look like you're afraid of the Drexel.
Yeah.
And I just shut my mouth for a while at that point, and I was prepared just not to do anything. So at the end of October, the week before the Night of the Living Drexel 2000, I was fired from Studio 35. Now, in the grand scheme of things, this amounted to an extended layoff because I was back at the theater by April and back as a full-time employee essentially by May.
Well, wait, when you say fired, was it... Did they say we just don't have room for you? We don't have the budget for you?
Well,
you pissed me off. Get the hell out.
No, well, that's coming.
That's how people, I mean, you say fired, that means that there was, mm-hmm. they wanted to get rid of you.
And I'll tell the rest of the story, I promise. Well, I'm not just going to do hot take and be like, I was fired, ha ha!
Well, you never know.
Take that!
You never know.
No, I was fired because John told me that the theater was struggling. They, according to him, they legitimately thought they stood the chance of closing at that point. I was the highest paid employee at that point. There was, he admitted, there was some residual bad blood from our mini tiff, our mm-hmm. schism, our little feud over the state of the marathons.
Yeah.
I told him that night when I was fired, because it happened at the end of one of my shifts, I said, I wish you had told me about this weeks ago. I would have quit if it meant the theater could stay open. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just, again, I've said this many times today, it was a confluence of many things came together all at once, and that happened. So I was gone from Studio 35 at that night. The bigger story in this whole thing...
But it still sounds more like we had to let you go as opposed to fire. You're fired! I mean...
Well, I was about to explain that, though. Yeah, I was.
Well, no,
I was,
you said it, then you gave the context, and then you...
I was continuing my story, if you'd let me finish my story.
This is the most roundabout way to say, you decided, I was fired,
you,
but no, everyone
no,
wasn't
you,
fired.
You decided to take the pull quote, the hot quote from that, like extra or
what
something.
What do you mean?
And then
I
like,
was fired. Well, wait, what does that mean? Well, I'll get to it. Yeah. So then I was fired.
Yeah, I was legitimately fired that night. Mm-hmm. The bigger story in this whole thing is there was never a Studio 35 24-hour horror marathon in 2000.
Yeah.
It didn't happen. Some of you are going to say, wait a minute. Next year, though, you did the third annual Studio 35 marathon. I've seen flyers for that. I've seen tickets for that. I've seen things mm-hmm. like that. Jumping ahead just a bit.
We'll get back to not really being fired in a bit.
Oh, Christ. I think I've told you the whole story at this point. You're such a fucking tabloid journalist. You know that? You're like, come on, let's get back to the hot stuff.
No, I'm asking you. Just go on.
Well, I told you the whole story. It was something that happened. I was gone. Eventually, I came back. We were amicable. We were fine. It's way, way under the bridge at this point. But it's the context behind what happened and the aftermath of what happened. So the next year, and we'll talk about this in a sec, but when I came back and we did the third annual 24-hour horror marathon, I didn't want to just say, oh, it's the second one a year after we had promoted the second one.
You didn't have to explain that.
So I took a page from Bruce's book when they did the sci-fi time travel marathons, when he time-warped ahead to SF-17.
Yeah.
I said, well, why don't we just say we did it last year and the promotion wasn't great? Which is completely in keeping with what could happen. Mm-hmm. I'll make up fake flyers, fake tickets, fake programs.
You already, well, no, I'll you even print had some, real tickets, didn't you?
Wait, hold on. And I'll even print some real t-shirts up. And we'll give them to the people who actually I know. And I'll say, hey, wear the t-shirt in line. Bring your stuff from last year in line. So if anyone starts asking you about this, you can show them, well, I have the t-shirt from last year. We'll essentially create a fake marathon that happened the year before, and that'll become part of marathon lore.
There's a lot of energy expended into this.
Well, yeah, but
subversive.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted the image. I wanted the image that we were still an event that was now in its third year and was chugging along.
And I'm the tabloid journalist who goes for sensation.
Yes, pretty
this
much.
This is a total William Randolph Hearst moment.
Pretty much.
Manufactured.
No, this is a completely William Castle moment.
Well,
is what this is.
Well,
and I went back on the flyer and I sprinkled in a few
Brian
titles.
Williams, maybe.
I sprinkled in a few titles that we actually would have shown. The Thing, Rock and Roll Frankenstein, The Raven. But I also included some titles that either I didn't want to show or that I had no intention of ever showing. Mother's Day, the trauma film. Vampires, Daughters of Dracula, a film I am not a big fan of. I put Bram Stoker's Dracula as one of the films we showed, but then on the program, and I explained this to the crowd, I said that the print never showed up, so we showed Dracula Dead and Loving It instead.
What I think so funny is the amount of detail that goes into the subversion here. You're like, Daughters of Dracula, which is a completely legitimate title to show at a horror marathon. You're just like, well, I would never show it because I'm not a big fan.
Well, that's
you have to know you so well.
Yeah, but that's why
and know you specifically
exactly. That's, but that's part of the trick is not many people would know that. But then if someone came up to me 2 years later and said, "Why don't you show Daughters of Dracula?" I could say, "Well, we showed it 2 years ago."
Not after listening to this podcast.
Well, this is way way later too. Way 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 later. So the fake lineup we constructed was Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Blade, 13 Ghosts, Twilight Zone the movie, Mother's Day, Rock and Roll Frankenstein, John Carpenter's Christine, John Carpenter's The Thing, we really liked Carpenter that year, The Raven, Daughters of Dracula and the Vault of Horror.
Again, most of Christine that lineup, and Mother's Day, I think, are completely legitimate marathon titles.
I think Mother's Day is a horrible film.
There's a you've shown a lot of horrible films.
Anyway, we're running out of time. Yeah, I know your attempts to try to take this off into other territory will not work on me today. Sorry, Jack. But that marathon, that one that is up today in the archives, that one that some people refer to today glowingly as, oh, the second one. The second annual Nightmare at Studio 35 does not exist. It never happened. On Saturday, October 21st, I was just working that night, I guess. Nothing happened that night. But today, we have tons of official marathon lore that have placed it, this mythical phantom marathon, into marathon history. And that's how that happened. So, if you're still listening, this is the end of the major exclusive part. That marathon that we said happened never happened.
Shall we move on to Night of the Living Drexel?
Yeah.
So, move on to marathon that actually exists.
So I got fired from Studio 35, I think, on a Monday night, and the following Saturday was the Night of the Living Drexel 2000, which was fun. Not great. Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, which...
I did not go to this one.
No. It was interesting. It was kind of fun. In a moment of cheapness, which I don't think I'll ever forgive him for, Jeff Frank did not want... I don't think he wanted to get the 35mm print of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, so he got a 16mm print and literally set up a Bell and Howell 16mm projector in the back of the theater.
Oh, wow.
Like, the house, and showed it on that, so it's like watching a classroom showing of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Was it at least plugged into the sound system?
I think.
Okay.
But the whole time, you're just hearing right behind you. I think I walked out for that part. Fright Night... The American Nightmare, pretty cool IFC documentary about 70s horror and the social motivations for it. The Fog, they took Bloodsucking Freaks from us once, and with my permission, once they knew we weren't showing it. Ah, that's a terrible film. Spider Baby and Hellraiser, which was a pretty decent event, and it had, I don't know, maybe 100 people or so. Mm. What's interesting about Night of the Living Drexel 2000 is it began... a conversation in line with some of the longtime marathon guys that would then continue into the next spring that would eventually lead toward the resurrection of the Studio 35 Horror Marathon. So that was the year 2000 in marathons. Spring 2001. The Arena Grand is supposed to be on its way at this point. The original plan was Arena Grand would be finished, I believe, by late spring 2001 or summer. Sci-Fi would be delayed, but it would still happen. And Sci-Fi would be one of the big kickoff events. Well, the Arena Grand was not finished. They had a setback. And eventually did get finished, but it didn't open until, I think, fall 2001. Later in 2001. Mm-hmm. Fall 2001. So, in the spring, as a stopgap, Bruce organized one of my all-time favorite marathons, and that is SF 18 and a half. The Sci-Fi Trailer-Thon, the 12-hour Sci-Fi Trailer-Thon with trailers, shorts, etc., April 7th and 8th at the Drexel Grandview. I loved this marathon.
It's a lot of fun. It is a little bit much having just, how many hours is it?
12.
12 hours of trailers. That's a lot.
And shorts.
Some shorts, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's all preview stuff. It's all pre-show stuff.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, yeah. I never got tired of anything in this entire marathon. Oh, yeah, you could fall asleep and wake up 45 minutes later, and you're just on to more trailers. It was great. This marathon is notable for one thing that some people will completely laugh at, and that is it was the, I believe, Columbus premiere of what I think should be a marathon favorite and a marathon legend, but some people just don't like it, and that is Space Boy! We were so excited when we saw Space Boy. Literally, I mean, that crowd, especially the long-term hardcore people, yeah. After it was done, there was a buzz in the air like, oh my God, this is the next great marathon short.
Yeah.
And over the years, people have kind of turned had on varying, varying opinions. I don't know about turned on it, but varying opinions of what it is. It's never achieved the status I thought it would.
There's no big sister in this one. You know what's funny? I got one. I was saying before we started recording, I have one good story from this one.
Yeah.
I dragged one of my friends, one of my filmmaking buddies. He lives out in LA now. But I dragged him to this one because I was one of the main pillars
squeezes.
Of the sort of like the brain trust creative brain trust we had in our little filmmaking group.
Yeah.
So I think he was just trying to appease me all the time. So
that's all anybody ever really tries to do, Kevin, is appease you, please.
So I dragged him to this thing, and this was at the Grandview, right?
Yes.
Now, down the road from the Grandview, if you were to walk out of the Grandview and turn right and walk down the road a little bit, before you start getting into like Goodale territory, there's a bar. Mm-hmm. It was a real tall building, and I remember we went to that bar, and I said, well, we're here for 18 hours. Why not have some alcohol? Because whatever, I don't think they served beer.
No.
They didn't serve drinks there.
No.
So they didn't have a bar there. So I said, well, let's go down there first. And either we went before the thing started, or we went right at the beginning, or we went out in the middle of part of it. But we got to the bar before, you know, during its hours. And I sat down and I had them line up a bunch of cocktails. And the guy got really nervous doing that. Apparently they don't like if you just line up, even if you pay for them.
Yeah.
They don't like you doing that because they think you're going to, like, get drunk and, like, either kill somebody or kill yourself or drive home.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up doing it, four or five of them. But, yeah, that was my, and then I went a little bit high on the
that's a
sauce.
Great, that's a great story, Kevin.
Well, it's just the fact that, right? have you ever tried to order, like, a lineup of drinks?
I don't drink.
Yeah. Have you ever seen somebody
I'm a teetotaler. Like Penn and Teller, except not as rich.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, though. Yeah.
No, but they don't like that. It was because I ordered it and the guy like got really weird to me. And my other, I don't spend much time in bars, but I had gone and done that. And my friend explained to me, he's like, yeah, they don't like it when people do that. I'm like, why? I see you do it in movies all the time. He's like, yeah, because usually whatever follows in the movie is what they
disastrous.
Want to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my biggest story from that. That's the only story.
It's a story.
Wow, you're just lashing
you
out
gave,
at me
you gave
for
me
the
guff
whole...
for being fired, so.
That's not
by the way, I'm
out
looking,
of context.
I'm looking at the flyer for the SF 18 and a half trailer-thon, and it has a bunch of little taglines all over it, and one of my favorites that I'm noticing right now is, no boring character development! Exclamation point! I love that. Warning, not for those with long attention spans. A perfect marathon for today. You heard that right, kids.
Scientific evidence.
Take
right?
that, Twitter.
Bring your smartphones. All right, let's move on.
Okay, so here's the
triumphant return.
Here's for me the big thing that came out of that trailer-thon. I'm in line talking with a few of the long-timers, including one Vince Cornelius, who many of you might know from many years of marathon going. He's been going since the beginning. And they're trying to convince me to bring the horror marathon back. And at that point, that's when Vince says, look, if you want, I'd be willing to provide some financial support. Because I'm back, I'm kind of back at studio at this point doing some film work for them, doing some build up and breakdown stuff once a week.
Unfired.
Yeah. And we were on good terms. That's the thing. Studio, even the week after I was out of there, we basically were on fine terms after the minor little blow up we had. I didn't know about pitching them a marathon. Vince says, look, if you need financial support, like to guarantee you won't lose money, I can probably do that. So about a month later, I formulate a plan and I go in with him and talk to John. And I said, John, I'm going to pitch you an idea to bring the horror marathon back. And I will guarantee you, you won't lose money on this event.
Okay.
So I pitched him this whole thing. And I had an intricate, like, 4-page presentation I gave to him that detailed every single aspect of this thing. And when it all
8x10 glossy photographs with circles and arrows on the back.
What it all boiled down to was me saying, look, if we don't make enough in ticket sales to recoup the costs, we will guarantee you the difference.
Okay.
And John bought into it. And he said, okay, let's do it. And thus was born, or reborn, the Studio 35 Horror Marathon. And this is when I got the idea that we talked about before. So we created the third annual Nightmare at Studio 35. And this was the first big guest that I ever had a hand in, and that was your pal and mine, Mr. Joe Bob Briggs.
Yeah.
Who is probably one of the nicest people I've ever met.
He was very cool. Events. I remember hanging out in the lobby just chatting with him.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know Joe Bob, by the way, because some of you, he's kind of past his peak of fame at this point. Some of you might be saying, well, who's this guy? So, quickly, back in the 80s, the Dallas Times-Herald in Texas had a film critic named John Bloom. And John Bloom was this very erudite Vanderbilt graduate who reviewed art films and was like a, you know, kind of a classic film reviewer. Mm. Unbeknownst to the breeding public, John Bloom also loved horror, sci-fi, exploitation films, the drive-in, blah, blah, blah. And he kind of wanted to work in a gimmick where he could review drive-in films. Because literally, especially in Texas back at that point, the drive-in circuit was huge.
Oh, yeah.
And you could still see a ton of like nudie pics and horror pics and sci-fi and low budget and all sorts of great stuff. So John Bloom created a persona known as Joe Bob Briggs. And it was intended to be a parody of redneck culture, but also a guy who, like a Jonathan Swift type satire of that culture, but also someone who could write, he could write in this persona and review legit drive-in films. Well, the Joe Bob character became huge, and he became like something that everybody loved to read. He also became controversial because, like any classic satirist, he would poke holes at all sorts of groups, feminists, minorities, the people in power, all that stuff. And eventually, John Bloom got in trouble for writing a parody of We Are the World, the Africa Benefit song called We Are the Weird, in which he made fun of several minority groups. In today, I mean, if you look at the context, it would be like, oh, well, this is just making fun of every sort of special interest group.
Yeah.
But there was a protest outside the offices of the Dallas Times-Herald by, I believe, the local office of the NAACP.
Okay.
And the Dallas Times-Herald fired John Bloom. Well, he just moved over to the Dallas Morning News, I think it was, or Dallas Star-Telegram or one of those, restarted the Joe Bob character, and then started a syndicated run of the Joe Bob character. He got even bigger. He got his own show on the Movie Channel, Joe Bob's Drive-In or whatever it was called, where he would host like a late-night double feature of exploitation films.
Wasn't it Monster?
Well, originally he was on the Movie Channel for a good 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Then that gig ended, and then eventually he ended up on TNT, in which he ran Monster Vision. And that a lot of people watched back in the mid to late 90s.
But that was also, I remember reading his columns were always in Hoot.
Hoot was like the source for his syndicated column in Columbus.
And he would write stuff. He'd always do a rundown of, he'd always start off by saying, okay, this is how many breasts you
see. The drive-in totals. Yeah. And he had all these great phrases he would coin, like sex was aardvarking. And he'd always say naked is naked, N-E-K-K-E-D.
Well, and so everything was something-something foo, like ninja foo.
Any kind of violence was something foo. So you'd have kung fu, head foo, chainsaw foo. Anything that was used for an act of violence could be that thing plus foo amended to that would be that form of violence.
Yeah.
And it was his own little vernacular in his own language. And if you go back and read the works of Joe Bob, and you can find some of them on his website, you can find some of them in the books he published of his collected articles, a lot of it's really sly stuff and it's great, but it's actually, you can see through the Joe Bob character, you can see John Bloom's total love of horror and science fiction and exploitation. So in 2001, Monster Vision had, I think, ended about a year before on TNT. Joe Bob was still at that point pretty much known for that. So I contacted his agents or his agent, and I said, hey, we're running this event in Columbus in October. Would Joe Bob / John be interested in coming out? And she said, absolutely, he would love to. And they were so nice. They said, well, if you pay for the airfare and a hotel room, he doesn't even demand an appearance fee. And because I had said, hey, we're a small theater and we're not sure how much we can pay him. I was kind of floored, like, wow, that's great. And they even found a discount flight for him.
Oh, wow.
And so he came out, and that was the big hook to me. That was the big
deal. No, that was a big deal, which is why, of course, you have Janet Leigh on the flyer.
Well, Well, originally we were going to show Psycho at that marathon, and then we found out that the Wexner Center was playing Psycho for their Halloween show. I really like this reissue art for Psycho. See it the way it was originally made, uncut, every scene intact, the version TV didn't dare show. And I kind of like that as almost an in-joke of the fact that we're back now and it's the horror marathon exactly the way it should be. It's uncut, you know, originally made, everything's there, all that stuff. So we had Joe Bob, but I also wanted to toss in basically any kind of special attraction we could have to try to bring people back in. Because I knew there would be some people who would say, wait a minute, there was no marathon next year. So we brought Nosferatu in like we were going to the year before. We had the Weird Lovemakers come in and do their live score.
Which was really good.
Yeah, the Weird Lovemakers, if you don't know, are Mark Gunderson, who was basically, he is the Evolution Control Committee, a famous, one of the progenitors of the mashup genre. Mark Gunderson and two partners of his. And they were kind of like electro lounge lizards, if that makes sense. They did a lot of stuff based around sampling. And their score for for Nosferatu was a collage, an audio collage of classic horror soundtracks, classic horror sounds, other things like that. Still to this day, like one of my most memorable things I was involved with, their live performance for that. We do have some video of it that maybe we'll put up someday. And Mark even said afterwards that was probably the best performance they had with that score, which they also did several other times in other places. We brought in Creature from the Black Lagoon in 3D, which is always fun. We had our first legit premiere, the Midwest premiere of The Convent. We also ended up having the Ohio premiere of Brad Anderson's Session 9, which we didn't find out about until the week before. But that was one I was proud of because that was a fairly decent mid-range art type film that had some pedigree behind it too. Mm-hmm. People still speak fondly of that movie.
Oh, yeah. I remember this is one where I dragged some friends, filmmaking friends too. And I think we left after The Convent because they all got tired.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting, because I remember seeing Session 9, I remember seeing The Convent because that was Adrian Barbeau.
Yes.
And I remember seeing Nosferatu and Carrie, and I remember Joe Bob's whole spiel.
Yeah, this was one, if you look at the lineup, I like this lineup. I think there's some oddities in here because I was trying to hedge my bets, hence Creature in 3D, hence Halloween. We knew where we could get a print, and I thought, well, anyone casual might see Halloween and want to come in for it.
Mm-hmm. Is that the only time Halloween has shown?
Showed at the 1993 Night of the Living Drexel, but it has not shown since this marathon. Hence Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which the year before was kind of part of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something to say, oh, Buffy's popular right now. Maybe this will draw people in. And people always had a good reaction to the Buffy trailer when we showed it at the marathons. Rosemary's Baby, The Howling. But you do have some hardcore titles, too. I Drink Your Blood was one. It was the uncut version we showed, which is one of the few times that's shown uncut on film. Mm. Last House on the Left, which got dropped in favor of Session 9, ultimately.
Mm.
Squirm, which got dropped in favor of Time because we were running behind. We did show it the next year. Carrie, which Joe Bob introduced and did the drive-in totals for. That was fun.
Yeah.
The Teenage UFO Psycho Monster Sex Show. Okay, a trailer show from our old pal and film promoter extraordinaire Johnny Legend, who you might know from being the brother of Lynn Margulies, who was Andy Kaufman's companion near the end of his life. Courtney Love played her in the film Man on the Moon. Johnny Legend actually had a hand in some of the goofy shorts that Andy Kaufman made, like My Breakfast with Blassie, where Andy Kaufman sits down with Classy Freddie Blassie, the pro wrestling manager, and eats breakfast at a diner in L.A. It's a parody of My Dinner with Andre.
Okay.
Johnny Legend has, like, he's either, like, help to direct that, or he has a cameo as some guy who wanders in and tries to interrupt them. Johnny Legend, who I love and I haven't talked to in a long time, pitched me on this idea that we could get the Teenage UFO Psycho Monster Sex Show. He said, it's great. It's like starts with a cartoon and it's the history of like Western civilization in trailer form. The way he pitched it to me was it was a combination of horror and sci-fi and exploitation and other things like that. So we got it. And he was touring around with this show. He was having it play at a bunch of theaters and repertory houses around the country.
Mm-hmm.
We get this, and I hadn't seen it. And about 15 minutes in, it becomes obvious that it's very heavy on the sexploitation angle.
Yeah.
And we show this at like 6 or 7 o'clock at night. Two things I remember from this were, number one, unbeknownst to me, the trailer for The Weird Lovemakers, the film, is in this show. And Mark Gunderson and I are in the back of the theater talking about Nosferatu, which he had just finished playing the score to right before.
Yeah.
And the trailer for The Weird Lovemakers comes up, and Mark had lost his voice this weekend, so he can hardly talk, and he sees the trailer, and Mark gets so excited and, like, pumps his fist, and he's like, ah, yeah, because how, you know, what kind of timing would that be that The Weird Lovemakers are playing at this marathon that all of a sudden, unbeknownst to us, we have the trailer for the film that they were based on. Nice. The other story is, there was a woman that came up to me near the end of the Teenage UFO Psycho Monster Sex Show, complaining about the nudie content. And she actually said, it's a horror marathon. I didn't come here to see nudity.
That's why I always went to the horror marathon. Like,
who are you?
Followed by Carrie, which is like the first.
Yeah, I know. It was strange. But
Howling, which shows later that.
I know. Yeah, but
and
that
Halloween
was like a minor blip.
Yeah, okay.
Joe Bob's appearance there was great. And like I said, he was so nice. And I look back at my involvement, and I was such a rookie. I booked him in like the Red Roof Inn that was up on Stelzer Road, which I thought, oh, it's close to the theater. This is great. Not realizing, oh, wait, that's a shitty motel.
Yeah.
But he didn't mind. He was a sweetheart about it.
Yeah.
After he did his drive-in intro for Carrie, and he gave the totals, we showed Carrie, and then he gave a Q&A afterwards.
Yeah.
After the Q&A, I said, hey, Joe Bob will be in the lobby to sign autographs if you want. I didn't even think to get him a table.
Yeah, he was doing it right on the concession stand.
Yeah, he was just standing by the stand. He never said a thing, never complained, never did anything. And actually enjoyed it. He stuck around. He stuck around through session 9. Mm-hmm. There are stories of him. I was watching session 9, so I didn't see these. But he sat in the lobby and had pizza and talked with some of the people, bummed a couple smokes off of some people. They loved him. He was great. He was fantastic. He spoiled us. In a lot of ways, he spoiled us because he was so nice. When he had to leave, we offered him like $250 as an appearance fee. He almost didn't want to take it until we said, no, really take it. My big memory of him was I didn't see him a lot other than talking with him in front of the crowd.
Yeah.
And right at the end as he was leaving, I wanted to tell him, hey, I really liked some articles you wrote recently because a month before this marathon was when 9/11 happened.
Okay.
And John Bloom was living in New York at that time, not far from Ground Zero. And he wrote this series of articles in the weeks after 9/11 as John Bloom about living in New York at that time. And they were really cool. And I remember saying, like, hey, I really enjoyed your articles about the World Trade Center attacks. That was like in a sea of jingoism and propaganda, you know, at the time, you know, you were alive back then. Reading his stuff was like really nice.
Yeah.
It was very level-headed, like you would expect from a smart guy like that.
Mm-hmm.
And very, it was a nice portrait of being in the city without getting into all the jingoism that was all over the place at that point in the country.
Yeah.
But he was great. He was fantastic. We've sometimes talked about bringing him back for something.
Hopefully you'll put him up in
a better than the Red Roof. Joe Bob,
if
you're listening to this, I apologize.
Joe Bob, we're going to put you on the Knights Inn.
We'll totally make that
161.
Up to you,
that's where people take shits on the floor and there's hookers in the parking lot.
Yeah.
You like hookers, don't you? Hookers.
Yeah. Today,
what for dinner?
Yeah. It was weird for me too. That was my first interaction with a guest, and I love Joe Bob. I mean, Joe Bob was like is part of the inspiration for what I became in life in general, for better or for worse.
Do not tell him.
So interacting with him was I had some butterflies in my stomach because I thought, oh God, this is the guy. You know, this is him, and I don't want us to look like buffoons. Which we did in any way, in some ways. I looked like a buffoon in some ways. But he had a really good time. The crowd had a really good time. And this was a great marathon for me because I had fears after the first couple years that things would kind of be difficult. And attendance this year was less than we thought. I think we had maybe, I think if I remember right, we had maybe 230 people or so. Mm-hmm. I thought we'd sell out with Joe Bob. I think some of it was promotion. I think some of it may have been a little bit of 9/11 hangover was going on at that time, but the crowd had a great time and the crowd was enthused and you could really feel like, okay, that momentum is building and this is really cool. Don't look now. Some people will still hate me for showing that, especially at the time we did. It was supposed to show at like 12:30, ended up showing around 2:30. There's a videotape from one of my friends who taped this whole event where at the end of Don't Look Now, you see the credits roll and he's shooting the end credits and it stops. And I walk up to him with the camera afterwards and he just says, thanks, Joe. Thanks a lot. Boy, that was fun. That wasn't it. I love Don't Look Now. Yeah. That's a fantastic film. It's not a great film to show at that time.
I've never seen it. Cause like I said, we left for that.
Here's a fun thing. I'm looking at the flyer and in my attempts to really sell this event, number one, I advertised that we were showing Night of the Living Bread with live bread. This was the first screening of Night of the Living Bread since the 1994 Sci-Fi Marathon where a theater allowed you and promoted for you to throw bread during the event.
Wow.
This would all pay off 2 years later with a certain world premiere of a film in the bread tetralogy, but more on that later. The other thing, you might find this interesting. I advertise on the flyer, free breakfast to all who survive. At one of the first Boston Sci-Fi Marathons, this is where I stole this idea from, they offered a free champagne breakfast in the restaurant that was adjacent to the Orson Welles Cinema, where they ran it at that point.
Yeah.
Free champagne breakfast for all who survive. So I thought, hey, in an attempt to try to keep people there near the end, because that's kind of our goal. We'll always give you
Egg McMuffins and orange.
Yeah, we're always trying to keep people near the end because it's more fun that way. Nothing sucks more than a marathon where there's like 20 people there in the last 2-3 films. Mm-hmm. So I gave a vaguely defined free breakfast to all who survived the whole thing. That ended up being bagels, a few donuts, and some orange juice and milk. You know, not anything great. But still, the people who stuck around till the end, they got some free food.
Yeah.
And it was fun. And this was a real sense of accomplishment because I felt like this marathon this was leaps and bounds beyond what we had done before.
Yeah.
And there was a real standard we were setting of professionalism. And I was at Studio 35, you know, back there employed, and kind of, I felt real ownership. And I really felt like we were beginning to associate the Studio 35 name with the Horror Marathon, which to me was really cool. And again, I give so much credit to John for that, to John Conti. This is turning into the John Conti tribute podcast, even though he's not dead. no, I'll say this again when we talk again about the next two studio marathons, but John is such a huge part of why the marathons and the Horror Marathons are where they are today, because John gave me complete creative control over the Horror Marathons at Studio. He let me do whatever I wanted to within financial reason. Not a lot of people would do that. There are theaters that run 24-hour marathons, even around the country, where ownership eventually takes over, and they say, look, why do we need you, the organizer? We can do this ourselves. John trusted me enough to say, you know what you're doing. You know more than I about how these events work. Do that, make some money, and we'll go into business together with that. And he's the reason why so much of the cool stuff at Studio happened, and in many ways, he spoiled me, I'll say that, because I wanted complete creative control for all time after that. Who doesn't? But yeah, I owe John a lot for that. And I think the marathon crowd, and especially the Horror Marathon crowd, owes John a lot. That period from Marathon 3 through 5 at Studio 35, I had a longtime friend tell me at the end of that three-year period, he felt like it was a new golden age for the Horror Marathons. Mm. And took that as a huge compliment. But I will always say, John enabled that to happen.
Yeah.
He allowed me to play around in his playhouse, I guess, or his sandbox. And we were successful, especially for those last 3 years. And it was a ton of fun. So coming out of that marathon, we had some real momentum, and there was no sci-fi that year because sci-fi was eventually canceled and postponed until the next year. But the Arena Grand was finally finished at the end of 2001, and looming in the spring then would be the first Arena Grand Marathon that we ever had. Do you have any other stories about?
No, not really. Once again,
the Horror Marathon.
Yeah, once again, that was just like I said. These are the times where I was sporadically appearing. Even when I was there,
You lost your faith, Kevin. You needed someone like me to bring it back. I believe it was 4 years ago when I said, "Kevin, come back, please." And you said, "Oh, Joe, thank you. Thank you for showing me the light."
I was fired.
You were fired. I fired you from the marathons. I'm glad that's what's going to come out of this podcast. But I hope in some way today we've been able to fill in some interesting little nooks and crannies and stories about a two-year period that was somewhat tumultuous, but also very interesting. And I think influential. I will say this, because I'm just remembering this now. Mm-hmm. I hate people who say, "I will say this," but I use it as a crutch.
You hate people.
The third Studio 35 Marathon, I made a promise to myself.
Yeah.
I said, I really care about these events. But I made a pledge, and I've held to that pledge ever since. Some of you will laugh at me saying I've held to this pledge, because your opinions of my involvement with the marathons might vary. I pledged myself when we started that third 24-hour marathon. I said, look, I love these events. I want these to continue to be as best as they can. If it gets to the point in the future where I think the Horror Marathon or the marathon I'm working on, whatever that is becoming compromised so much that it's going to become a shell of itself, I'll quit.
Wow.
I made it that was my credo at that point. I said I would rather quit while I'm ahead than string out the marathon to be really crappy for a long time if it would get to that way. And I have held to that sometimes to my temporary detriment ever since. But that's kind of my guiding principle today. I would much rather walk away from the Horror Marathon or sci-fi now that I'm more involved. I'd rather walk away if I knew it was going to become bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because I take a lot of pride in that. And I think Bruce does too. We both do.
You don't want to be seen as an enabler for it to completely fall apart.
Well, yeah, we'll talk more about this in the next time when we talk about the final two studio marathons. But I very much ran into that credo at the end of my Studio 35 days, where I thought I would rather go out on top than have this turned into something I don't want it to be.
Yeah.
And I would rather have people have good memories of when it was good than to say, yeah, boy, it's been pretty crappy for the last 2 or 3 years because they're really phoning it in. I never want to phone in the marathons. And again, some of you might laugh at that and think, haha, you've been phoning it in for years.
Don't cry for me, marathon.
Yeah. But that was kind of a galvanizing event for me that year, and it's held true ever since. But that's 2000 and 2001, and I think next time we have a little Arena Grand madness to talk about, a little Arena Grand odyssey.
Maybe just a tad.
Which was a new venture for the marathons and a really interesting part of the marathon history.
Yes.
But...
That's another story!
For the time being, I've been fired by Kevin Carr.
You're fired!
He's given me the fist and the ooh, hello! What? Whoa!
What?
Oh my God.
No, that's something totally... No. We will see you next time.